Welcome to the FAIR Podcast. The Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing well-documented answers to criticisms of LDS doctrine, belief, and practice. To learn more about FAIR or to make donations, visit fairlds.org. I'm Blair Hodges, host of the FAIR Podcast. This episode features Professor Terrell Givens from the University of Virginia. We'll discuss his work on the Book of Mormon, Mormonism and culture, religious searching and certainty, and other topics. Questions or comments about this episode can be sent to podcast@fairlds.org or join the conversation at fairblog.org. I'm joined by Terrell Givens. He's a professor of literature and religion and holds the James Bostwick Chair of English at the University of Richmond. He's a prolific Mormon author. Some of his books include Viper on the Hearth, Mormons, Myths, and the Construction of Heresy, By the Hand of Mormon, the American Scripture that Launched a New World Religion, and People of Paradox, a History of Mormon Culture. His newest book from the Oxford Very Short Introduction series is on the Book of Mormon. Thanks for joining us today, Terrell.
Good to be here, Blair.
First, I want you to talk a little bit about your background in Mormon studies, how you became interested in Mormon studies.
I did an undergraduate degree in comparative literature at Brigham Young University, which I think gave me good experience in reading texts and in looking at broad cultural contexts for historical and intellectual developments in Western history. I then went to Cornell and studied intellectual history with Dominique Lacopra and Jonathan Culler. And after finishing my coursework there, decided that I missed comparative literature. So I went back to Chapel Hill and finished my doctoral degree in comparative literature there. And fully intended to pursue a career in 19th century British literature until my father, who happened to be a collector of Mormon memorabilia, began passing on anti-Mormon literature to me that he had been collecting from the 19th century. He found it quite interesting and thought that maybe I should take a look at it as a literary scholar and do something with it. And so rather reluctantly at first, I agreed to do that. And as I did, a whole world kind of opened up to me as I realized that nobody had, or very few people, had actually looked at the phenomenon of anti-Mormonism through the lens of literary studies rather than historical studies. And the result of those early investigations was my first book, Viper on the Hearth. And after doing that book, I thought that I was going to go back to British Romanticism, when it occurred to me one day, soon thereafter, that the Book of Mormon was the most widely distributed book ever produced by an American, and there had never been written a single book about the Book of Mormon published by a non-religious press. And when I raised that observation with Oxford, they invited me to work on a volume, which I then did, and that was the book you mentioned, By the Hand of Mormon. Now I seem to be firmly stuck in this field, for better or for worse.
You mentioned you looked at anti-Mormon literature from a literary perspective rather than a historical one. What kind of questions would you bring to bear on that would differ from a more historical look?
Well, I think that we've become more sensitized in recent years to the extent to which public perceptions of religious groups are largely mediated through culture, through media like popular fiction in particular. And so it turns out that popular fiction did really important and really interesting cultural work in the 19th century. And so far as it used the resources of literature and of literary representation and caricature to alleviate what I call the anxiety of seduction that seemed to be so widespread in the 19th century, Mormonism presented a unique challenge in American religious history insofar as it was widely perceived as a threat, as something that was alien and hostile to American institutions and values, but it produced or it engendered a unique phobia because Mormons couldn't readily be recognized as most foreign entities or other ethnic groups could be. And so it turns out that one of the functions that literature accomplished was to reconstitute Mormonism into a distinct kind of ethnic category. And the success with which that was brought off is evident in such facts as if you go to a reference library and look up Mormons in the Harvard Encyclopedia of Ethnic Groups, you'll find Mormons listed as an ethnic group. So I think in large part that's a result of a very effective campaign waged in the latter half of the 19th century to create Mormons, as I said, as a distinct ethnic group.
When was that Harvard Encyclopedia done?
Well, that's the current edition.
So that's a reverberation from back then. Even you see that as kind of a carryover from the...
Absolutely. And, you know, sociologists and historians disagree on exactly what nomenclature is appropriate for Mormons, but they all agree that something about Mormonism transcends mere denominational status. I mean, it's been called an ethnic group, a subculture, a global tribe. But it's clear that there is something, as I said, that renders them a distinct community in ways that other religious groups really aren't constituted.
So then you moved on to the Book of Mormon, and I mentioned the Oxford book, the very short introduction. I wanted to talk about a couple of things in there. You decided to focus more on the content of the Book of Mormon there as opposed to what you had done in By the Hand of Mormon, which was kind of look at the cultural history of how the Book of Mormon's been seen and used. What led to that decision?
Well, the first problem that presents itself in writing about the Book of Mormon is how do you avoid the Book of Mormon wars? How do you avoid the fact that the Book of Mormon has always functioned for Mormons and for non-Mormons as a sign or barometer of the truthfulness of Joseph Smith's message rather than as a carrier of meaning in and of itself. And I wanted to avoid that. So the easiest way to do that in the first study was to just do a reception history where I studied the impact, the way in which the Book of Mormon was used, viewed, interpreted, constituted by detractors and proponents. And that allowed me to some extent to avoid the question, is it true? Or what is the spiritual value of this record? In the second project, which I did for Oxford, I thought that it was time to turn attention to the Book of Mormon itself. So one way that I did that was I tried to avoid even mentioning Joseph Smith until as late in the book as was possible. Because as soon as you mention Joseph Smith, he assumes center stage and the Book of Mormon recedes into the background. And so I tried to do just a kind of formal overview of the Book of Mormon. What are its themes? What are its main characters? How does it constitute itself? What is the narrative strategy that's employed? And I hope I carried that off.
And that sort of approach seems to be a little different from what you saw early Mormons doing with the Book of Mormon. In By the Hand of Mormon, like you mentioned, you see it as sort of, they viewed it as a sign. Prophecy is back. Joseph Smith is a prophet. Would you qualify that at all now that you've had some distance from that book? Did you find more that sustained that thesis or more to qualify it?
Well, the more work that I've done into early church history and theology, especially looking at the work of Parley Pratt seems to be an exception to the general rule in that he found the Book of Mormon worth study and he preached sermons from it. He found that it was doctrinally rich and substantive, but I think he was by far the exception. The more you study early Mormon proselytizing, for example, the more one becomes convinced that the missionaries were primarily using the Book of Mormon as a sign that Joseph was a prophet. They testified much more about the testimony of the witnesses, read from the testimony of the witnesses more than they would read for doctrinal import.
Do you think that played into the cultural expectations? Did they want that kind of more proof? Did they want that more concrete connection with angels here or men who beheld the plates?
Well, absolutely. In the first generation of Mormonism, of course, Western religious culture in general was immersed in a millennialist worldview. And so the Book of Mormon was Exhibit A in the list of evidence that God had reopened the heavens, that miracles were again happening, God was interacting with humans. And so the Book of Mormon was a kind of sacred icon, a sacred relic that was a physical or tangible embodiment of God's interaction with the world.
You mentioned Book of Mormon wars, and from that I gather it's the idea of whether or not it's a true history or whether Joseph Smith wrote it or someone else. There's an interesting part in your introduction to the Book of Mormon here where you're talking about the Anthon experience where Martin Harris takes the characters to Professor and tries to get him to verify these things. And later on, Anthon said, hey, that, you know, I didn't say that this was accurate or anything like that. And Martin Harris walked out of there convinced that Joseph was getting it right. So you write that in a pattern that perfectly epitomizes Book of Mormon wars to the present day, detractors and believers alike found in the episode clear collaboration of their respective positions. And near the end of the introduction, you talk about how you kind of expect that to continue. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it seems that the race, if you will, to win the Book of Mormon wars by conclusively demonstrating either that it is a 19th century production or that it is an early American artifact has been going on neck and neck from 1830 to the present. I mean, Alexander Campbell lobbies the first salvo when he claims to have found in the Book of Mormon evidence of all kinds of 19th century borrowings, right? He says it's filled with the preoccupations of the 19th century religious controversies. And then a few years later, Joseph Smith is excited because John Lloyd Stevens has come back from Central America and discovered ruins that seem to corroborate the Book of Mormon's story of ancient, highly sophisticated civilizations. And it's gone back and forth like that ever since. Archaeologists find stone altars in Yemen with an inscription of the name Nahum, which seems to corroborate Book of Mormon historicity, just as other anti-Mormon archaeologists conclude that there isn't a single whisper of evidence anywhere in the record in the Western Hemisphere to corroborate the Book of Mormon. Mormons invoke word prints or Hebraisms, and the opposition continues to uncover more and more examples of 19th century cultural similarities that are rather suspicious. And it's my personal belief that it will never be definitively resolved one way or the other.
One thing that Alexander Campbell also brought up was the profound Christology of these supposedly pre-New Testament Israelites. And you talk a little bit about that in terms of Prisca Theologia. What do you mean by Prisca Theologia? How does that come to bear on the early Christology of the Book of Mormon?
Well, this is another example of where the exact same evidence that supports Mormons in their faithful account strengthens the arguments of the opposition, depending on how you construe the evidence. In other words, Joseph Smith created a vision of the gospel as something that goes all the way back to Adam. And if that's true, then one would expect to find elements of the true gospel in all ancient traditions that precede by centuries the Christian era. And so when you find in a text like the Book of Mormon evidence that 600 years before Christ, people were using his name and teaching his gospel, Mormons would say, well, see, that's just one more example of how ancient the gospel is. Whereas a non-Mormon would say, see, that's proof positive of the fact that we have all kinds of anachronisms here that undermine the historicity of the Book of Mormon.
Okay, and in your study of the Book of Mormon, for this very short introduction, you close the book by talking about the impact that the Book of Mormon will continue to have on Mormons, and also it seems a hope that the more non-Mormons will gain interest in the book. But you quote a fellow named Sidney Ahlstrom, I believe he was a religious studies scholar, and in 1972 he said, "A few isolated individuals can still read the Book of Mormon as a religious testimony, but not even loyal Mormons can be nourished by it as they were a century ago." So he saw it as becoming more and more irrelevant. And what's your take on that?
Well, I think what he said was demonstrably true up until the era of Ezra Taft Benson. And I think that he effected a successful paradigm shift in centering the Book of Mormon in the Mormon consciousness. And I think to this day, it's far more common for members of the church to spend time studying the Book of Mormon on a daily or weekly basis than it is for them to be reading the Bible. And I think they do that in and find exactly that spiritual nourishment which he thought was absent.
In the introduction, you decided to focus on some of the themes of the Book of Mormon and bring a literary analysis to bear on it. And some of the things you point out are really interesting. I was interested in a very simple comparison that you made between the opening of the Book of Mormon and the opening of the Book of Genesis. So if you opened up the Bible and began to read versus if you opened the Book of Mormon and began to read, you're getting a different account. Can you talk about some of the differences there?
Well, the Bible is conspicuous as an example of cosmic history. It purports to give us the history of all things, of the created universe, and it begins with this kind of portentous in the beginning, and we have God, and we have chaos, and we have order coming into the universe. And then as the focus narrows, it only narrows very slightly insofar as we have told to us the history and destiny of great nations and great peoples. The Book of Mormon begins with the exact opposite kind of emphasis, where we're given a specific time, a specific place. We're in Jerusalem. It's 600 BC. It's the age of Jeremiah. There's a man named Lehi. He's not the leader of a nation or a great people. He's an individual. Very soon, his life becomes preoccupied with very particular family problems and family divisions and issues. And so what we have is a radical focusing of the Book of Mormon, and by analogy, a focusing of God's interest on individual destinies rather than cosmic or even national histories. And that seems to be one of the great messages and one of the great emphases of the Book of Mormon. is the extent to which God is a God of individuals, and the extent to which God's revelations are dialogic revelations that are targeted toward individual concerns rather than matters of great or national import alone.
It seems to me that you believe Mormons take that view and apply it in their own lives. In the Book of Mormon, there still are some pretty striking instances. For example, Alma the Younger, an angel appears to him, or Nephi hears the voice of the Lord and then has a great vision. So we have these dialogic revelations, but some of them in the Book of Mormon, most of them even, kind of seem very grandiose compared to what an average Mormon might expect. How do you think a Mormon can reconcile that?
Well, I think there's no question that just as the gifts faded in the primitive church, so there seems to be a diminishment of the spiritual manifestations and gifts in the restored church. To some extent, that's a function of any church that becomes institutionalized, normatized over time. And to some extent, that was a deliberate strategy on the part of church leaders who wanted to de-emphasize spiritual gifts. I think it's a natural process. I think Mormons have accommodated themselves in some ways by changing the lexicon of scriptural resources that they use in order to identify or define the nature of spiritual experience. For example, instead of focusing on those Book of Mormon episodes where we have angelic visitations or interaction with angelic beings, we emphasize those verses that originally were given to Joseph Smith to describe the translation process that have to do with feelings and impressions and stupors of thought. And that has become the template, if you will, for revelation. So that's one way that Mormons have accommodated themselves to a less charismatic church.
Another thing that's interesting about a literary analysis of the Book of Mormon is what you call the Chinese box structure of the Book of Mormon. What did you mean by that?
Well, Grant Hardy has done the most impressive work in this regard in showing that the Book of Mormon is a literary work of phenomenal complexity. And just keeping track of the genealogy, if you will, of any particular passage or part of the text can be a very difficult enterprise. We have brass plates, which become incorporated into Nephi's record, which become incorporated into the teachings of Abinadi, which become incorporated into the gospel that Alma is teaching, which becomes part of what is read before the people of Zarahemla. And so that's what I mean by this sense of Chinese boxes, that we have scripture that is incorporated and assimilated into ever new and ever burgeoning contexts, in a way that doesn't just reveal a literary complexity, but I think it also says something about the nature of Scripture, that Scripture is infinitely recontextualizable, if you will.
And is that what Nephi means by likening? Is that
exactly. I mean, what we see in the Book of Mormon is Nephi as the Midrashist par excellence, right? He can take any Scripture and adapt it to his particular time and circumstance. He encourages his readers to do the same, and then I think the Book of Mormon becomes an object lesson in precisely how to do that throughout a period of 1,000 years.
And while Nephi's doing that, it seems, at least the translation doesn't make him seem like the most poetic of writers. You mentioned that searching for literary wonders in the Book of Mormon is a bit like seeking lyrical inspiration in the books of Chronicles or Judges from the Bible. What are some of the lyrical inspirational bits that you have found there in the Book of Mormon that have impressed you?
Well, I think that the poignance and the beauty of the Book of Mormon isn't to be found from any particular passages, though there are some of those scattered throughout. I think that the great dramatic intensity of the Book of Mormon comes from the contrast, the narrative structure that juxtaposes Nephi, who represents the dawn of Nephite history, an era full of hope and promise and great expectations, and this, I mean, the entire destiny of his people lies open before him, with full of promise and potential, and that's contrasted with the almost unbearably tragic story of Mormon, who personally witnesses the utter destruction of his people, who were once so fair and delightsome. In his words. So I think it's a great story of failed hopes, of ruptured families. It's rather like Genesis begins also in family strife, family conflict, and ends with this heart-wrenching scene, right, in Pharaoh's house where the children of Israel are all reconciled to one another, and it ends in this kind of hymn of unity and these beautiful blessings given to the posterity of Isaac. Whereas the Book of Mormon ends in the opposite direction. It ends in apocalypse and destruction. And the only glimmer of hope that transcends this tragic tale is the set of gold plates.
So we have that in a pretty sizable book, and it takes a little time to, I think, dig that out. Why do you think God would use a book like that to get such a message across? Why this book?
Well, that's a good point. Grant Hardy has made the observation that if the Book of Mormon was just to serve as a sign of God's dealings, he could have used a pamphlet. Why almost a 600-page work? Well, I think that if one looks back at the history of the Book of Mormon, one sees that there's been a very slow and very gradual growing appreciation for the value of its content. I've always been struck, for example, by the fact that the most radical innovation of the Book of Mormon in terms of a doctrine is the teaching of the fortunate fall. And yet Joseph Smith never commented on that doctrine, as far as I can tell, nor did the Pratts. It's a doctrine that is repeated in the Pearl of Great Price, and yet it lay there buried and unnoticed and unappreciated. And so one wonders, well, how many other teachings or doctrines in the Book of Mormon have we not really plumbed the depths of because we haven't turned our attention to it with enough devotion and intellectual rigor?
Yeah, that's one of the doctrines you mentioned in the very short introduction. Is one of the strikingly novel doctrines, as she calls this idea of the fortunate fall. What's the most striking difference about that? Then talk a little bit more about the fortunate fall and how that comes to bear on the entire Christian cosmology.
Well, it's almost as if that is the missing piece to render Joseph Smith's theology complete. And we have completed it more or less by insinuation and inference. But Joseph, right, as early as 1832-33, he's already developing his ideas about the pre-existence, the premortal existence of the human spirit. Given the fact that Joseph posits this anthropology that places our the human soul in a premortal realm, in the presence of God, with the potential for theosis to become actually like God, it becomes immediately evident that this temporal existence has to be a phase of ascent rather than a time of decline or fall. And that's precisely what is taught in Alma. And yet Joseph, somewhat remarkably, used the language, the Protestant language of the fall throughout most of his ministry. He would refer to Adam's fall, to Adam's transgression, to the fall of man as something that had been remedied by the atonement of Christ. But the Book of Mormon, I think, gives a more accurate and plausible, sensible view, which is that there wasn't any fall. There was a transgression on the part of Adam, but the ascent, if you will, of the human spirits into the temporal plane was part of the process, eventually leading to theosis, not a setback.
And this is a question that bears more on Mormon theology, and that's sort of the project that you're working on right now is a look at Mormon theology. Tell me a little bit about that project.
I do have a contract from Oxford University Press to write a 2-volume history of Mormon theology. And I'm attempting to do this by positing a few theses. First of all, I want to make the point that, as I said, as early as the early 1830s, Joseph already had fairly well limbed out in his own mind the entire plan of salvation. What he spent the rest of his life doing was filling in details and connecting dots. But I don't believe, as other historians have tended to emphasize, that there were dramatic shifts or changes or evolutions in his religious thinking. I don't think that...
You're talking the periodization.
Exactly. It's become almost commonplace to say, well, there was a Kirtland theology, and then there's a Nauvoo theology, and then there's Joseph the Mystic. Well, certainly there's growth and development. But as I said, if you have the essential anthropology limbed out in 1832, pre-existence, and we come here, the temple exists as that place where pre-existent potential is actualized in terms of eternal durable relationships that lead to theosis, that's the essential theology of Mormonism. And I think virtually every other doctrine and principle can be fit into that scheme in one way or another. And so that, I think, in part is what I am attempting to do. Not in order to systematize, but rather to show the coherence of Joseph's thinking and to show the process by which that historically unfolded in the early church and beyond.
And there haven't been very many works specifically dedicated to the idea of Mormon theology. We have Sterling McMurrin did some work on that. More recently, Blake Osler has done some of his own kind of creative Mormon theology in some books from Coford. Why do you think Mormons haven't spent more time looking at the idea of theology in Mormon?
Well, I think the view that has long prevailed and goes all the way back to Brigham Young, one can find in Brigham Young and his successors pretty vitriolic language referring to the enterprise of theology. Hugh Nibley very famously said, theology is what happens when revelation ceases. And so I think Mormons have been very skittish of the word for that reason, and also because theology suggests to most Mormon minds a kind of stasis, and nobody wants to ossify a tradition whose underpinnings are in continual revelation. So the difficulty is, how do you write a historical theology without becoming normative? And that's one of the challenges that, of course, I'll face, is I don't want to presume for a moment to be declaring or arbitrating when there are theological differences or disputes among various leaders who have spoken on theological issues. But if we consider theology as simply a kind of rigorous reflection upon our faith, then it's obvious that we can't, or at least we shouldn't, escape the burden of our own theology.
In doing that, looking at historic thought, as you mentioned, you're going to find some contradictions. You're going to find some church leaders saying one thing and others saying another on various topics. There's a sociologist in the church, Armand Moss, and he has a really interesting quote that you use in your book, People of Paradox. Moss says, "Abandon certainty, all ye who enter herein. Never again will you enjoy the immunity to doubt and ambiguity that went with your previous life. But then the ability to live with perpetual ambiguity is also a trait that distinguishes adults from adolescents." And he's talking about the Mormon tension between certainty and searching. How is that borne out in your research?
Well, I think that this is one of the great cultural challenges that Mormons face. Mormons can be distinguished from other faith traditions in many ways, but one of the most conspicuous to non-members and to visitors to our chapels is the rhetoric of certainty that one finds, for example, in a Mormon testimony meeting. It's an unusual kind of discourse to stand up and say not what you believe, not what your faith is, but what you know. And I think this creates an almost unbearable pressure on that segment of the Mormon populace who don't feel that they can testify with certitude. I think it's a little sad that Mormons tend to remember the spiritual gift that is given in the Doctrine and Covenants, that to some is given to know, but they don't read the rest of the verse that says, and to some is given to believe on their words. And so I think there needs to be more room in Mormon culture for not just the certitude, but the ever-searching heart as well.
How could that room be created?
Well, I think in part it could be created by a more accurate reflection on the life and ministry of Joseph Smith. Jill Durr once said to me that she thought the early church was a mixture of revelation, imagination, and negotiation. And I think that's a great way to describe the prophetic enterprise as Joseph Smith understood it. Joseph Smith was continually reaching out and striving and speculating at the same time that he was having theophanies and heavenly visitations. But he certainly understood that uncovering the fullness of the gospel was a proactive endeavor and not a passive one. I've always thought one of the greatest lessons of his life was that after he had shown the ability to translate plates from an unknown language like Reformed Egyptian, he hired a Jewish schoolmaster to teach him Hebrew, which is a pretty good indication that he felt that we have to add the hard work of perspiration to the gift of inspiration.
And as far as abandoning certainty for you, what are some of the things you've run into in your look at Mormon theology that have left you puzzled?
Well, I don't think anybody's ever going to crack the mystery of polygamy and of the various and, to our minds, strange phases and versions that it went through. I don't know that I have achieved any great insight into those kinds of problems, although I think that one can come closer to understanding what might have been going through Joseph's mind in terms of his quest for kinship, his priority of dynastic relations and family associations and friendship in his ministry. But that's one mystery that will always remain.